Hello, my name is Bonnie Fenton from Rupesh Consult, and we are here at Mobility Planet today talking about sustainable urban mobility planning and smaller cities. And I'm here with my colleague, Ralph Brandt.
Thank you, Bonnie. Yeah, my name is Ralph Brandt, colleague of Bonnie at Rupesh Consult here in Cologne.
And we also have with us a guest, Lasse Brandt, who is no relation to Ralph. They just share the last name. Lasse, it's nice to have you with us. Can you maybe give us a few words about yourself and your background?
For sure. Thank you for having me. Lasse Brandt, my name, 35 years. I'm joining from Malmö, where I work for WSP, a Swedish big building and planning company. Well, my background is in social and environmental sciences, and then focusing more on the area of transport, motivated quite a lot by the climate challenge of how we can change this important area of emissions. I previously worked for Rupprecht Consult, where I worked for 5 years, mainly with sustainable urban mobility planning, so with today's topic. And then since last year, when I moved to Sweden, I started working for WSP, where I am also working with traffic strategies, but I'm also working quite a lot with more detailed planning, parking strategies, analysis and assessments related to urban development. So a little bit more also on the groundwork of traffic planning.
Okay. So more direct then, yes, because we were sort of a step or are maybe a step removed when we're talking about SUMP in theory, and now you're looking at what this looks like on the ground. So maybe even another perspective or more depth that you can bring to the work that you already did at SUMP at the more theoretical level. So maybe I'll just give you one thing too. We talk about sustainable urban mobility planning. Sometimes we say SUMP or sometimes SUMP. So we may hear one or the other of those terms as we go along, just so you're aware what that is. Sustainable urban mobility planning, SUMP, SUMP. And so we talk about SUMP in general. And in fact, we develop guidelines for this within our office, but there are also different aspects maybe that can be looked at in more detail. And what we're thinking about today particularly is SUMP or urban planning in smaller cities. Lasse, you were the main author of guidelines on this, so you've given it quite a bit of thought. Maybe we should start with some basics. So what's a small city?
That's a very good but not so easy question, because it depends on what country you're in. And that is something we encountered when we developed the guide that, yeah, it can be quite different. And in some countries like Germany, where cities tend to be bigger, a small city tends to be also defined as a small, bigger city. But in the end, in the guide, we decided for 5 to 100,000 inhabitants, and then also a certain density criterion of at least 300 inhabitants per square kilometer. But in the end, I think the numbers are not so important. What we tried to carve out with this definition is that there is a lot of people living in smaller cities that are neither big metropolis, which really have a big population, really developed public transport, and so on, but they are also not living on the countryside, where maybe you have just some farms and very small settlements and no public transport at all. But a lot of people live somewhere in between in these cities that are, they have a decent size, they have some services, they have an urban core of some kind, but they are not these huge cities. And that's what we wanted to focus on.
Which I think is really helpful, because oftentimes when you think about these big sort of planning processes, you imagine that taking place in large cities, and maybe people from, or we'll say maybe planners or those working in smaller cities might not necessarily feel directly spoken to, because it seems like, ah, that's something for a big city. So we've talked about there is the SUMP guidelines, and then you created this small city guidelines. Can you maybe just tell us who did this and where did this come from? Just so we know what we're talking about here.
The guide was developed within the Civitas SUMP sub-project. So we involved a lot of the partners and a lot of the partner cities. And I think the main inspiration and content came from a round of workshops with around 20 to 30 smaller cities. So we gathered several times and they did a course on SUMP, but we also had a lot of interesting discussions at the workshop where they reflected on how does this apply to my city, how do we do it in reality. And there were very many interesting discussions that we based a lot of our recommendations on. And then when we had a good outline, we also got it reviewed by a bunch of experts on traffic planning from different countries. And there was some from Sweden and from France and from Hungary and different countries. And usually those were kind of very renowned experts in their countries that then also again reviewed it from their country perspective. Like in our country, would this also work or is everything arranged very differently? So I think we have quite a solid thing here that was reviewed.
Okay, that's probably really important to say. And I think particularly knowing that the input from this has come from smaller cities that were involved in this European project that you were working on. So it's not just, a theoretical exercise, but it really was based on what the experience is in small cities and towns. So we know what sorts of areas we're talking about, places with a certain amount of density and up to roughly 100,000 inhabitants. Maybe the question is, what are the differences? You've already touched on those a little bit, I think, about the services, but maybe you can be a little bit more specific about what the differences are between smaller and larger cities, and why is it important to give guidance, particularly to smaller cities?
Well, why is it important? I think I'd like to develop that a little bit, because that's something I've encountered a lot in my contact with smaller cities or planners from smaller cities, that they have this reaction to general planning guidance that, yes, all of this is very nice for bigger cities, which have the right resources, the right capacities, enough personnel. This is all very nice to do, but unfortunately, I'm sitting here alone. I'm the only traffic planner in my town, and I just don't have the time to go through such a long process. I have all the ambitions, but it's just not, I need something that's a bit more, it's shorter and focusing really on the needs in smaller cities where some things are more important, but other things are less important.
Maybe we can go right to that then. Can you tell us, give us an idea, like what is more important or what is less important in a smaller city than a bigger one?
I already mentioned public transport before, because that's always one of the first topics that gets mentioned. It simply is quite difficult to have an attractive public transport system in a smaller city. And when we speak about maybe 50 to 100,000, okay, there still you have something. But even there, often you only have a few bus lines. If you're lucky, you have a train stop, but that's not due to your own efforts. That's then decided on higher political levels.
Sure, and that takes you to another city rather than serving the city that you're in. It's not moving you around your small city, the train station, I assume.
Even though, of course, it has an important function for you either to take you to another bigger city somewhere a bit further away, or also to bring people from the rural areas to your smaller city if you're kind of a regional core.
So public transport is one thing, certainly.
Yeah, we emphasized a lot in the guide that a strong regional cooperation is extremely important, that as a small city, it's quite limited what you can do. There are certain things that you can do, and we have practical examples in the guide. But to develop that one on a regional level, that is really a key. And then depending on the country, there are structures in place for that already, or maybe you have to be in the driving seat also as a smaller city.
Bonnie, something that kind of popped up and kind of made me realize something important is that one in three citizens in the European Union actually lives in towns of that size, 5 to 100,000 inhabitants. So we're talking about a third of the EU population that lives in these cities. So the importance of that is just gigantic. And also, I think distances traveled in these towns are typically probably longer than in cities, because of commutes. I mean, a commute can easily be 20, 30, 40 kilometers in these areas, I guess. So that's where a lot of the also carbon emissions, I think, are generated. Was that part of the original motivation for why this guide was produced in the first place?
Absolutely. I mean, we saw that smaller cities are very underrepresented amongst the cities that develop SUMPs, but also generally amongst the planning dialogue and the case studies that are out there. It's much easier to find examples from bigger cities, and smaller cities, they're just not so much part of the discussion. And as you said, a very big part of the population, one third, is living in these types of cities. So if we really want to transition the transport system and make it climate neutral, for example, sometime, they have to be part of the solution. We can't just forget them.
We're talking about some of the challenges, certainly with public transport. Are there good sides? Are there advantages? What works well, and maybe what might be easier in a smaller city than a large one? I can imagine, for example, communication should be easier, as there were maybe fewer people to talk to and everybody knows each other in a smaller city. What are some of the positive sides here? What might be easier?
For sure, it's easy to just focus on the problems, but there are also a lot of advantages that you have in smaller cities. Communication definitely is one of them. If you get the right people together, then you can change a lot of things quite quickly and quicker than in bigger cities. It can also be easier to get all the important people around one table because there's just less of them. And they might even know each other because the whole organization is not so big. There's less politicians, less different institutions that you need to involve. So that's definitely one thing. If you get the right movement going, then it can be quite quick. But another thing is also that, reflecting a little bit on the pandemic, smaller cities are actually the place where many people want to live. They offer some things that bigger cities have problems to offer, which is a nice natural environment, calm and good for families in many cases. I think sometimes in the planning context, we focus a lot on big cities because there has been so much urbanization and there's been so much development and growth in the big cities. And that's why we've forgotten about the smaller cities. But the smaller cities, they offer a lot of life quality that people actually would like to have. And if we only also then get the communications, the traffic and the access to services and cultures in place, then I think they have a really nice future.
Ralph talked about the longer distances driven, which is almost counterintuitive because we're talking about small cities. But of course, that's understanding that people are driving to other cities and not staying within their own community. Certainly, commuting is not the only kind of transport that we have. There are all sorts of day-to-day things. Or if I think about kids, they go to school in their own town. What about travel for that? Are they being driven to school? I'm thinking just these, there are shorter distances in shorter in smaller cities. What does that mean for the mobility?
Yeah, shorter distances, I think, is another big potential. As Ralph said, that many people rely mainly on the car, and many families also have several cars. But that is also due to the fact that even the children, in many cases, will be driven to different activities, maybe to school, even though there are shorter distances, because there's a certain structure built up, or the family puzzle is built up around the car, that first you drop off your kids at school and then you drive on to your... But I think if you manage in a smaller city to get the feeling that, it's safe, that my kids are just cycling to school on their own. We're a small city, but we have nice cycle paths. We have nice walk paths. It's actually possible. There is no chaos of cars in front of the school when they drop off all the children, but it's well organized. Maybe it's even blocked for traffic during school start and school ending, or it's just very traffic calm. So if you get these things, the conditions right in a small city, then I think you can relieve a lot of families that they don't have to drive around their children a lot, which is one of the things that we hear a lot when you do dialogues in smaller cities, that people feel, okay, but I need my car all the time because it's just not possible. It's too dangerous, or these kind of things. I think that's something where a smaller city can really get going and just if you get the right conditions in a smaller city, then you make life easier for, especially for families. And also from the kids' perspective, of course, they love to go to school on their own, to meet their friends on their way to school and back to school, and to really encounter the surrounding, to develop
the freedom and independence for a child then to be able to walk to school. It's interesting that this, so a child will be driven across a small town to get to school for two reasons, because the parent is driving past anyway to go to another city to work, and because they don't believe that the infrastructure in the city is safe for their child, which it's interesting. It kind of leaves you with the focus maybe on a school seems like a good way to go for a smaller city, thinking about routes to school for kids and for walking and cycling. So as we said, the public transport maybe is less of a focus here in a, at least in the really the smaller cities, but a focus on walking and cycling could make a really big difference, it sounds like, to provide the independence for kids and some freedom for their parents as well.
Yes, and that's why school mobility is also the first among the 10 measure fields that we recommend in the guide, because it can be a very effective and low-hanging fruit where you can get a lot of support and also generate a lot of support for further changes amongst quite a big part of the population, because you don't only reach parents, but you also reach grandparents and to friends of the parents. So in total, you will have quite a good outreach if you manage to have a positive change with school mobility.
I mean, I guess it would be interesting for our listeners to hear about the other 9 measure field foci or something.
We don't need to go through all 10 necessarily, but if maybe the top 3 to say what are the other ones that are interesting, important in a small city?
Yeah, it's hard to say what the top 3 are because it depends on the context. I think these 10 measure fields can be more seen like a menu that each small city can pick their fitting dishes from. So not all of them are maybe relevant for all smaller cities, but some of the things in there will be. So you can go through them as a smaller city, as a planner, and you pick the things that are most relevant, most urgent. Because maybe some city already has done a lot of work on school mobility, then this will not be the focus. Then maybe you focus more on cycling because you've seen, people don't dare to cycle anymore. There were much more people who cycled before. Maybe that's because on our main street, there is a traffic safety hazard. And we've got a lot of complaints about a certain part of the main street where a lot of big trucks are going. Then maybe that is a focus for you. It's hard to generalize, but I think school mobility is definitely important. Traffic calming in residential areas, I think, is also important in almost all small towns. And if I can only pick 3, then maybe a lively city center, a lively town center. Almost all of the towns, they have some kind of town square or center with shopping that used to be a lively area, and many are maybe struggling to keep it alive, to compete with all the big shops that are the hypermarché and the big supermarkets.
And the online retailers, I guess, as well.
And the online retailers, of course. So to work with this center, to what can we do here? How do we keep it attractive that people come to the center and meet?
A really important point. I know a small city that I lived in for a few years, and really the main street of it, the main shopping street, was also the main road passing through the city. So it wasn't really the place to stop, but it was the place to drive through, and the speeds were really faster than they needed to be. So this idea of maybe not having the through road being the main street of the city center, having a place that's separate from that. I wanted to touch on one more thing that you mentioned, I think, briefly early on, this idea of what kind of small city this is. And maybe I'll just give you the term functional urban area, and you can take that maybe and sort of put this into the context of maybe start with what is a functional urban area and how could different small cities or towns fit into that?
That's one thing we were also struggling with in the guide, that it's hard to have one guide for all types of small cities. Because depending on where a small city is placed and located in a functional urban area, they can have very different traffic structures also. But to start with, what is a functional urban area? So correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it's an area of urban settlements that have so tight interconnections that they work as one functional area. So there are certain criteria for how many people are commuting from one place to the other. And if there's above a certain threshold, then you're part of the functional urban area. So any big city will have a, like Cologne, where you are sitting, has a lot of smaller towns around it, which have many people who commute to work to Cologne. They will be part of that functional urban area. But in some cases, a smaller city can also be part of its own functional urban area. If you're relatively small, but you're the biggest one around, then you're a regional center and have your own functional urban area. And then you will, of course, have a very different structure than if you're just a small town next to a very big town.
Yes, which already, I think, is starting to show some of the complexities of this. If we're talking about a small city or a town that's located next to a large city, and then I guess we come into this question of how is this done? So if you are, say, one of the suburban cities around Cologne, then ideally you would be part of the sustainable urban mobility planning process that's taking place in Cologne, right? So you wouldn't just be doing your own process, but you would be a part of that larger process. As I understand it, Cologne is in fact getting ready to start such a process. So I don't know if we need to be handing them advice, but it seems really important then that they need to be talking to all of the cities and towns around the city of Cologne. Is that correct?
Yes, of course. Ideally, you would be part of the SUMP process of the metropolis. But in reality, an SUMP process within one big municipality is already a very complex thing. So even many bigger cities, they have some kind of dialogue with the functional urban area, but it's not always that in depth that this is sufficient for the smaller city. I think all smaller cities, regardless if they are in a functional urban area or the center of their own, they need to take an active role. And they need to understand what are my interests, where am I sitting in this structure, and how do I develop my positions also towards the bigger city?
That's you kind of answering my question with that too. It's this question of, so me, here I am in my smaller city or a town. If you're close to a big city, that doesn't mean you're off the hook. You still need to make your own, do your own processes and think about what your goals are and what's important to you. And if we talk about, say, schools as being an important aspect in a small city, which is what I hear, or in a town, having an attractive city or town center, that doesn't change based on the fact that you're located next to another, to a larger city. But it might make a difference, for example, in what sort of public transport is available to you, that it's important then to have good public transport connections into the big city. And maybe that will reduce the number of car trips that need to be taken from your small city into the larger city. And that then has the domino effect maybe around the kids, that you can say, okay, well, I'm taking the train, so you take your bike or you walk. So all of these things, I can see them fitting together when we're talking about the small city and its relationship to a larger one. Is that a fair statement?
Yes, definitely. I think you touched upon the different measure fields or different topics. And that's very important because in some topics, the regional cooperation will be very important. I mean, regional public transport authority will make the calls on anything related to trains or regional buses. So there, maybe the smaller city can mainly voice its position to them, but can't take the decisions. But then for other topics like school mobility or how do I regulate parking in my city, this will not be dealt with on the regional level. And the metropolis, Cologne, will also not necessarily care about it so much. So this is something you have to do yourself as a small city. And that's something that will be an important part of your SUMP then.
It's interesting. All this comes together when you say parking, and I say, oh boy, that's a problem, certainly in Cologne. So I can imagine that it's in Cologne's interest that the public transport is good. And so you in your small city don't feel the need to drive your car into the city of Cologne. So again, we've got these overlapping interests there. But that does make me actually think of one thing, because we talk about, you would come to the idea, I think, of developing a sustainable urban mobility plan if you have problems. And in a big city, parking generally is a problem. in a small city or a town, it's not such a problem, maybe in general. I think there generally is more space and there are fewer people, maybe less density. Is that an issue still? What about parking in a small city or a town? Is that something that is a concern?
Yes, I think it definitely is a concern. Let me be, just because you mentioned issue or problem.
Yeah.
I would like to quickly mention that this is also something I think that explains why many smaller cities don't see it as important maybe to develop a traffic strategy or SEMP, because they say, oh, but there are no traffic problems here. I mean, we don't have the congestion and the bad air quality that you have in the big cities. But I think they actually have other cities that are very much related to transport. And that can be, for example, the main street that you mentioned, that it's just not very nice to be on that main street, that maybe it doesn't attract people anymore like it did. The shops have trouble. Also, things related to health, that people on average move less. There's not so much daily activity just related to you moving. If you're always mainly sitting in your car, then that can also be something. And then what I mentioned with the kids, of course, that children get the opportunities that they deserve, that can also be. So I think all of these economic and social factors, they are definitely something that are important in smaller cities, and they are related to transport issues. So to not only narrowly think, congestion is no problem here, that's why we don't need a traffic strategy, I think that's important.
Lasse, you said you were working with us at Rupesh Consult, and now you're working maybe more directly with cities and towns. Can you give us an example? Do you have any experience that you can give us hands-on working with small cities and what the issues have been?
I think the best example is that during the last year, we developed a traffic strategy, so essentially an SEMP, for a small city called Falköping with around 17,000 inhabitants. So 1-7, not very big. There were, of course, a lot of different aspects that played a role, but one of the main discussions was around the role of parking in such a city. And that was very related to the shops in the center and the central square and that area, because in Falköping, they have quite a nice central square that has some green elements and so on, has shops. So it is attractive in a way, but still it's perceived that there is some kind of parking problem. That on the one hand, there are some people complaining that you can't park all the time at all days and easily always find parking. And then other people say, there's too many cars here around the central square. So, and I think this is a discussion that you can have in many small cities, this situation. And then the way the discussion went was that in the end, we landed in that parking fees didn't have enough support amongst politicians, but a strategic approach towards parking time limitations. So the amount of time you can park in a spot, that was something that they could agree on. So to decide, are the most attractive places right here at the central square? Maybe it's not efficient if somebody parks their car there for 3 days in a row. Maybe this is space that we want to use for somebody who, for example, comes to drink a coffee here in a cafe or to go shopping and only is there for maximum an hour. So even in a situation where parking fees are out of bounds, I think it makes a lot of sense to think about parking to use space efficiently. And also in smaller cities with only 17,000 inhabitants, space in the center is valuable.
Is the parking for free in this small city, or do they pay for it?
It's mostly for free, apart from some private parkings.
Yeah, interesting. So again, I mean, these are certainly issues that you can recognize in larger cities and in smaller ones. So to know that this is also an issue, to be in a closer and attractive place, but the value of that space is clear. And say, giving it for free to somebody for 3 days when other people could maybe use it in a more efficient way doesn't seem to make a lot of sense. So, but it sounds like there was discussion around it and then people are recognizing what the issues are, which is also important.
Yeah, and I think what kind of turned or channeled the debate in the right direction was to not put people who drive against people who don't drive, thinking about people who drive with different activities and about using space efficiently so that in the end we make it nicer for everyone. It's not about favoring one group against another group. It's really about our town and how do we use this nice square in the best way possible.
Which is a really fair point, I think. Yes, we don't need to shame people for their activities, but recognizing probably what our common goals are here that we want to see an attractive town center.
We've talked a lot about certain types of problems, certain kind of measures or measure fields, I think they're called also. I want to use the opportunity to draw attention to the process, the challenge of planning systematically. I think I understood, Lasse, you were saying there's not an easy kind of checklist approach, do this and this and this, and then you'll be fine. It's a very complex process to identify your problems in a systematic way, to analyze your current situation, develop a vision. But you said early on, in many smaller cities, there is really a lack of capacity, staff. I mean, there might be good intentions and the perfect will to do something. But do you have any advice on how smaller cities can handle and manage such a process? Maybe they might lack some data. SUMP is a very ambitious process and maybe originally designed with bigger cities in mind. But how can smaller cities manage this complex process? Or should the complexity be reduced? That's another screw you could turn, theoretically.
Yes, and I think that's what we tried in the guide, to reduce the complexity. We took the SUMP process, the known one, the cycle with the 12 steps that is the core of the SUMP guidelines. We took that one and we tried to condense it to really just pick out the stuff that is important also in smaller cities. And we, in the end, we came to the conclusion that all of these 12 steps are important. But many of these steps can be done much quicker. And you don't have to do all of the sub-steps that are mentioned in the guidelines. So we kind of summarized and condensed a lot. So our guide is quite a lot shorter on this process part than the main guidelines are. And the idea behind that is that this guide is not an add-on. It's not like you first read the main guidelines and then you read this. It's you only read this if you're a smaller city. And then you get all the content that's in the main guidelines, but you get it in a more condensed form that fits your context, hopefully better.
That must be a relief for some cities to hear that. Thank you.
So smaller cities, smaller guidelines too, which also makes sense. And I think maybe this is, as Ralph said, I think a relief that the process doesn't have to be as complex. And I think also building on the positives that you identified earlier, this idea of having maybe the shorter distances, or maybe your health person is across the hall rather than across the city, or the economics person, I don't know, maybe plays on your football team with you or something, that the relationships, the connections are much closer than they would be, which is also, I think, plays a role in simplifying the process. But it also, I think, just in that short description that you made with economics and social, makes it so clear that this idea, we call it sustainable urban mobility planning, but it really is planning that makes a difference in so many other ways. It's important in a large city, but I would say probably equally important, but important in different ways in a smaller city, which I see is why these guidelines are probably important, that you're facing different challenges and they need to be addressed in a different way.
Yeah, and I'd like to say something about complexity. It's so tricky. And that's one of the main recommendations also in the guide. Don't make it too complex. Don't make it more complex than it has to be. Of course, it's easy to get stuck in a very, very detailed analysis. Yeah, maybe you don't have the numbers on all side streets, how many cars are driving here, how fast are they driving here. But maybe you have a good impression of the traffic situation based on lived experience. Do, of course, the proper analysis and go through all these steps, but don't get stuck in something that takes too much time. And the same with the measures. Of course, you could do the most advanced traffic signal steering thing system, but maybe that's not the number one challenge in your small city. There's always low-hanging fruits that you can first address before you go to the more advanced measures. And the recommendation is to focus on the main challenges and to take the low-hanging fruits.
Which is really interesting and a good place to wrap up. And I'll ask you, I'll say one final question around that. You talk about, say, high tech versus low hanging fruit. These guidelines that you developed for sustainable urban mobility planning in a smaller city, do you think, is this something that any small city or town across Europe would be able to use? Or do you think this is really something for just those really advanced or high tech cities? Or can you put this in a context for us? Is this something for everybody in every small city?
I hope so. And I think I'd like to come back to this idea of a menu, that not all of this in the guide is relevant for everyone, but there's something in there for everyone. And also, if you are a smaller city that is not part of a lot of EU projects or has all this extra funding, just has the normal resources, even then you should be able to do something. And this guide is there to help you. That's why it's kept quite practical, and there's a lot of practical examples with maybe contexts. Maybe you just take out one or two interesting measure ideas from this guide and you just do them as a small city. But that's fine as well.
The guide was published in 2021, I believe. And since then, the world has changed quite a bit, actually, specifically referring to the EU mission cities. I mean, over 100 cities have committed to become seriously climate neutral by 2030. And taking this as one backdrop, and the other is something you said earlier about low-hanging fruits. Yes, there are certain measures that can easily be implemented. What I'm increasingly fascinated by is this a new sobriety, a new honesty about where are the big levers to reach climate neutrality. Maybe the low-hanging fruits aren't the ones that really deliver climate neutrality. So in light of these two kinds of thoughts, what do you think the SMP topic guide on for smaller cities would maybe even benefit from an update or an annex or something in the light of this climate neutrality seriousness?
With the risk of contradicting, I think climate neutrality is incredibly important. But if you're a traffic planner in a small city, maybe it's not your biggest argument to convince the rest in your town to change something. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's not the biggest concern in their daily lives, that this city is going climate neutral. So I think, yes, that's definitely important. But my recommendation is almost more to use other arguments, all these economic and social things that I mentioned, to make the case for some change that also is leading you towards climate neutrality. And maybe not the low-hanging fruits, they are not the most important aspects that reduce emissions in the end. But I think it's also important to keep in mind momentum. Kind of change comes with momentum. So you need to initiate some political energy, some positivity around change to then take the next steps. And that's, I think, what we are trying to recommend, that start with something that gives you momentum, mm-hmm. and then you will much easier take other steps that lead you, for example, to climate neutrality.
All right. I like that momentum argument. I think that makes a lot of sense. Yeah. Thank you.
But now I was just reflecting climate neutrality, that I haven't mentioned the word electric car a single time, but that's probably also the big elephant in the room, that the discussion at the moment goes a lot like, oh yeah, we mix in biofuels. And then from when we phase that out, when electric cars are dominating, and then we have fixed climate neutrality, especially in smaller cities in the countryside. So that's kind of a strong tone in the debate, which I think is not enough, but I think that's something that many people think, maybe.
We've touched on a lot here. Low-hanging fruit, how to build up momentum for action, what real motivators are for change in a town or a small city, and of course the cautionary message that electric mobility is not a silver bullet. you for joining us for this episode of Mobility Planet. Indeed, we can't forget that there are important differences between planning in big cities and small ones. Special thanks to Lasse Brandt for his contribution and his insights. Mobility Planet is produced by Ruprecht Consult, who also compiled the topic guide Sustainable Urban Mobility Planning in Smaller Cities and Towns as part of the project Sums Up, which was funded under the European Union's Horizon 2020 program. To hear more episodes of Mobility Planet and to find out more about our work on sustainable urban mobility, you can visit our company website at ruprecht-consult.eu. I'm Bonnie Fenton. Thanks for listening.